This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Well, I think every automaker in the world believes that the future of the auto business is electric. They are all preparing for that eventuality, even if the sales aren't really there. Because if you take all the electrified cars on the U.S. market, which includes plug-in hybrids and hybrids, you're still at only about 5% of the market. So they're not putting out cars like that because of a perceived demand in the market. They're putting it there because they're afraid of getting left behind.
Did you know that the three best-selling vehicles in America are all pickup trucks? This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with auto expert Jim Motovalli about the truck craze, which is now well into its third decade. He helps us understand how, in this era of eco-vehicle innovation, gas guzzlers still rule the day in the USA. Then we discuss the latest developments in the electric vehicle space, examine the phenomenon that's Tesla, and talk about ways that car owners may reduce their carbon footprints. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jim Motovalli. He is a car expert and a author. Jim, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be on.
While the world burns and there's global pandemics and markets are reeling, I wanted to take a step back and talk about cars for a minute. Not just cars, but trucks. What are the best-selling vehicles right now in America and why?
The best-selling vehicle in America is a truck. It's the Ford F-150 pickup truck. It's been the top-selling vehicle for like 20, 30 years. Nothing seems to be able to knock it off its throne.
And when it came out, I remember thinking, well, this is a flash in the pan. People just are going through Napoleon complexes, and everybody thinks they're a cowboy, but this is stuck. What do you attribute this wild success to? It can't just be marketing.
It's not just marketing, because the SUV fad initially caught car makers by surprise. People think that automakers pushed the public into SUVs, but it actually happened the other way around. Cars like the Jeep Cherokee really took off, and it was a little unclear as to why, and automakers responded by offering more and more SUVs, and people kept on buying them. If I'm asked for an explanation of that, I'd say it's because people buy cars with their heart, not their head, and the SUV has gotten the image of you're a iconoclast, you're an adventurous person, you're able to go off-road at a moment's notice, even though only 10% of owners do, and it's irrational, but it's got the, and the same thing actually condemns the minivan, which is actually a more practical layout, as, you know, the soccer mom car, and people have deserted those in droves, even though they're far more practical than SUVs for most people, and also better fuel economy. An accompanying phenomena to this, though, is the most popular subset of the SUV is the crossover. And crossovers are basically based on cars, and they are capable of getting very good fuel economy. And essentially, it's a car with a slightly different body. So my objections to the SUV are actually less than they used to be, because they're really indistinguishable from cars at this point because of the crossover thing.
But trucks stand out, don't they? I mean, we're looking at an SUV from 20 years ago would be considered a crossover today, right? Like, these trucks have gotten so big that the Ford F-150, the Chevrolet Silverado, and the Ram 1500, which are the three top-selling vehicles in America, some of them are so big that they don't fit in average Americans' garages.
Yeah, that's true. And I recently had an F-150 test car, and I was just amazed at how big it was. And I couldn't see how that size was practical for anyone. I mean, you have to climb into it like you're climbing into a buckboard.
And these full-sized pickup trucks, they're roomy, but surveys show that drivers don't necessarily have more of an attachment or aren't necessarily happier with their car than some Honda Civic owner.
I think it's interesting. If you look at Consumer Reports, which does owner satisfaction ratings, it's not easy to go by that because some of the cars with the least dependability have the highest owner satisfaction. For instance, cars like the Corvette, it's not particularly dependable, but it's got very high owner satisfaction. Tesla, which I think builds great cars, doesn't have excellent reliability, but it has the highest owner satisfaction in the market. Like if you're, or Porsche, which I believe has the highest ratings, I don't think they're the most reliable cars either. It's just that people aren't in love with their Honda Civics the way they are with their Porsche 911s.
Also, if you've invested so much in it and you get that feedback from society that you have a fancy car, you can afford to pay for reliability problems. You're not expecting a Porsche to be a Honda Civic. It's not going to run for 200,000 miles without you ever having to change the oil or et cetera.
Another factor is company like Tesla, which provides pickup and drop-off service for when they're doing work on your car. And I think people really like that. That's going to increase owner satisfaction. Even if it has to go out more often than another car, it's pretty painless if they pick it up and bring it back and give you a loaner car in the meantime.
But trucks themselves are pretty impractical, especially for how most people use them. Unless you're a contractor or a cowboy, you probably are driving a lot by yourself. You're parking in small spots that really aren't built for your enormous truck. And the cabs themselves are not an ideal space for, let's say, a family of four to go on a 3-4 hour drive.
Well, that's what I think. And I always have them, when I have them and I have to move stuff, I'm thinking, is it going to rain? The stuff's going to get all wet. And even if it doesn't get wet, it's sliding around back there and getting destroyed. Now, the answer to that is to put a cap on your pickup truck. But if you're going to do that, why don't you just get a minivan? I don't get it.
Or a big trunk.
Yeah.
And you live in Connecticut and I live in San Francisco. So somebody in Savannah, Georgia might be laughing at this conversation, thinking these guys just don't get it. What are we not getting? Like if we were in Wichita, Kansas right now and driving into a Walgreens and saw that 8 of the 10 cars there were enormous trucks, and we talked to all 8 of those people. If we asked them, are you going to buy another truck after this one? What do you think most of them would say?
Oh yeah. They're definitely getting another truck.
And then if we asked them, what made you buy your first truck? What do you think their conscious decision would be?
Let's be kind here and recognize that a lot of the people are probably working people that need trucks.
Do they really need that, though?
They may not need one that's that big, but they perceive, in any case, like I said, it's a purchase made by the heart, not by the head. And if you perceive a need, you're going to buy that way. In other words, many people buy for something they do once a year. Like they might move 7 people once a year, so they'll buy a 7-person vehicle. I never understood that. I wouldn't do that, but a lot of people do that.
No, I think that's you've hit upon it, is people are very afraid of, for example, I live in San Francisco where a lot of people go skiing up in the mountains, and you see a ton of people with 4-wheel drive vehicles. I bet they don't go up to the mountains more than 3-4 times a year at most, but it makes them want to drive a bigger car or an SUV because of that. We kind of have this risk-averse nature that leads to very poor buying habits. We can call it our heart, but it's our fear. What'll happen if we have to move a couch and we don't have a pickup truck? God forbid.
Robert Putnam wrote a book called Bowling Alone, and it's about how people tend to do things on their own when they used to join bowling leagues and things like that. And he makes a very good point. I think what would have made sense is you borrow a pickup truck from your friend, when you need one. I mean, that's what I do. I have a friend who has one, and I use it occasionally. But I don't feel the need to own one for something I'm going to do once a year. And it's impractical exactly. The rest of the year. But, of course, you can do things to your pickup, like have it have a crew cab, which means it has front and back seats. But then it gets even bigger.
Well, then you got to get a bigger couch.
Yeah. I don't get it. I don't get it, Alex. But, you know, I just report on what people do. Not, you know, I don't influence them to do what they do.
Sometimes late at night, oh, when I'm bathed in the firelight, the moon comes calling a ghostly way, and I recall like a rock, standing arrow straight, like a from the gate, like a rock, carrying the weight, like a rock, oh, like a rock, the sun upon my skin, like a rock.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to car expert Jim Motovalli. So, Jim, with the coronavirus and global economy on shaky ground, we're looking at oil prices that have gone down recently 20-25% just in a day alone. So that will translate into cheaper gas. Will that mean even more people buying trucks? Or do you think that as the economy cools down, we're going to see just less vehicle sales in general?
The American default position is to buy as big as you can. Very high gas prices, like above $4 a gallon, will actually cause people to make choices against what their preference would be. Like they would choose something smaller. And there have been periods where people really have gone for smaller cars because of gas prices. The cheaper gas gets, the more people will buy bigger cars. They don't see any penalty to it. The amount they pay for gas isn't a factor, so they'll just get something bigger. We're seeing a little bit of consolidation in the auto market. We're seeing sales being slightly off, not a huge amount. China has overtaken the U.S. as the biggest car market in the world. And I think we could see people being affected by economic conditions, which will cause reduced sales or maybe a move into small cars also, or smaller ones, or just cheaper ones, which tend to be smaller. I think we probably will see that if the downturn caused by the coronavirus continues.
You mentioned Tesla and its high customer satisfaction. Maybe you can talk about how some of the traditional big three and other car manufacturers are faring in the electric car market.
Well, I think every automaker in the world believes that the future of the auto business is electric. They are all preparing for that eventuality, even if the sales aren't really there. Because if you take all the electrified cars on the U.S. market, which includes plug-in hybrids and hybrids, you're still at only about 5% of the market. So they're not putting out cars like that because of a perceived demand in the market. They're putting it there because they're afraid of getting left behind. Tesla is very influential on the market in that if you look at the sales of the Model 3, which has been out, I don't know, a year or two now, it dwarfs the comparable Japanese and German luxury cars. So there, people are really perceiving a sea change there where an electric car is outselling comparable gas cars. And everybody wants to build, you know, the next Tesla. So the automakers have started to come out with cars that could indeed be serious competitors to Tesla. Porsche has the Taycan. I just saw it yesterday. I'm down in Amelia Island, Florida, at the Amelia Island Concours d'Elegance. And Porsche had a stand in which they had their Taycan, which is, I think, a very effective fighter against Tesla. Audi has a similar car, except theirs is an SUV. And we also have a couple of upstart electric car makers that I think are pretty serious. So basically the industry is going electric. And like Volvo, I was just on a trip with them, and pretty much all of their cars now have plug-in hybrid or hybrid variants. And by 2025, all of their cars will be electrified to some extent. So automakers are moving very much in that direction without necessarily getting the market signals about it.
So do you think the Porsches and the Audis and Subarus of the world are going to lap the GM, Fords, and Chryslers because of those three companies' inability to really hit pay dirt with successful electric vehicles thus far?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think General Motors came out with a Chevy Bolt, which is a pretty effective electric car. They got ahead of any of the other car makers. Ford is coming out with the Mustang Mach-E, which, at least on paper, looks like a really impressive electric car. Only Chrysler has just been a consistent laggard in the field.
And yet we have a situation where Tesla is making just a small fraction of the amount of cars that GM, Ford, and Chrysler produce, and yet their market capitalization as of January 6, 2020 was $84.6 billion, and the next largest of the big three was $50 billion of GM. You know, GM, Ford, and Chrysler combined is $114 billion. So the market has given Tesla a lot of room to work with, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. And Tesla's really never made money except in a few quarters, and only if you look at the numbers a certain way. It's not a profitable company by any measure, and yet it has the rapt attention of every car maker, every Wall Street trader. I mean, it's because everyone perceives it as the future. In fact, Tesla has unveiled a lot of things on its cars that are now standard practice throughout the industry. An example of that would be the big touchscreen, you know, that looks like a tablet, but it's the screen. That was Tesla.
Instead of a traditional dashboard.
Right. And the idea of over-the-air updates, where you can update the software on your car, it could just be done invisibly without the car owner having to do anything. Everybody does that now. Tesla was the first to do it.
And so what do you think Tesla is hoping to do with this enormous leeway that the market has given them? It's kind of given them a license to really experiment and try to do something significant in terms of changing the face of the way we drive.
Right. And I think it's doing what it should be doing, which is, instead of just, you know, giving its shareholders big dividends, it's plowing the money back into developing new models, which is very costly, and which they've been doing since they were started. The result is they now have a more diverse product line with the Model S, the Model X, and the Model 3. They're about to come out with a smaller crossover SUV called the Model Y, and the Tesla Roadster, which is going to be incredibly high-performing, is about to be unveiled also. So all their money has really gone into, it's one of the reasons they don't make money, is they're constantly developing new models. Also, this is an important thing to say, is that Tesla's cars always have more range than everybody else's. And this, to me, is a key flaw in some of the mainstream electric cars we've seen so far. Like the Nissan Leaf, to me, just doesn't have enough range. And that's why they came out with the Nissan Leaf Plus, which has 200 miles of range, but I think that's still not enough.
Yes, give us a breakdown of some of the ranges that are out there in the market, and maybe speak to how companies like Tesla are addressing something called range anxiety.
Range anxiety is a very real thing. I currently have a car I'm selling for a relative, which is a 2016 Nissan Leaf. And its actual range is about 85 miles, and it's worse when it's cold. And that is just not acceptable, really. You can't use it for that much.
How long does it take to charge it up?
You'd have to charge it. You basically have to charge it every night.
So 85 miles per day, basically. You can't just do a quick charge and then be off and running again. So it's not really feasible for any lengthy trips.
The automakers have, basically, a lot of them would look at the way people drive and say, well, most people don't drive more than 30 miles a day, so 85 miles is enough range. If for every reason that's wrong, that's bad thinking. People perceive that they want a lot more range than that. Whether they need it or not, maybe they don't, but it's like driving a gas car where the gas gauge is always on empty. 85 miles is not enough. I would say the average today is probably around 200 miles, which is barely acceptable. Something like the Audi's electric car, the e-tron, I think that has about 200-mile range, and the Jaguar I-Pace also. I just don't think that's enough. They need more range. They need 300 miles of range.
It goes back to why people buy a pickup truck. They're worried about that one time when they need it. It's part of our electronic world. I mean, you turn on your phone, and if you saw that it was 20% to start the day, you'd think, oh, no, I better charge up my phone. You wouldn't be like, oh, I'm fine. I got 20% left.
Right, right. I think that range anxiety will go away because I think we're close to making, say, 300 miles of range standard. And I think we have the battery tech for that. Tesla has never been afraid to put big battery packs in cars. The other automakers have mostly been reluctant to do that. They're starting to do that. But, I mean, it does create some issues. Big batteries tend to be heavy, and they take longer to charge. So those are issues. Tesla solved this by having this supercharger network around the whole country, which can fast charge cars in like 30 minutes.
What do the oil companies think about this?
Oh, I would say that they don't. They think Tesla's a big threat. I'm sure they do. It is.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to auto expert, author, blogger, Jim Motovalli. This week's show is dedicated to the memory of McCoy Tyner, who passed away at the age of 81. So, Jim, we're talking about sales of new cars. A lot of sustainability experts in the field, like yourself, have looked at the carbon footprint of producing a new car. What would you say to somebody who's looking to either buy a used car, whether it be electric, hybrid, or even a pickup truck, versus a brand new car, even if it's a fully electric vehicle? How does that compare to the impact that you're making in terms of your personal carbon footprint?
The greener choice in terms of your personal carbon footprint is to buy used, though the effect may be not as great as people think. For instance, the manufacturing impact of a new car is maybe 10% of its lifetime impact. So that is something, it is something to be thought about. I mean, for instance, painting a car is probably the most environmentally dangerous, but they have done quite a lot in automakers to reduce the impact of that by using water-based paints.
Wait, I had never heard of that before. So explain what was the environmental problem with painting a car? Was it the CFCs or something?
The emissions from the process and also the disposal of it was messy. In fact, I've seen some things recently where they reclaim unused paint from the painting process and use it in the cement industry. I think Honda does that.
Really?
Actually, the automakers have done a lot to make car factories better than they were. For instance, a trend, almost a craze among the automakers is to have, you know, zero emission plants that they offset a lot of the emissions or reduce the impact of the process. They zero waste is what I should say, not zero emissions, zero waste. So they figure out ways to reform the process so there isn't as much waste, and then they rehome the waste. They find places for it to go. Like I said, the paint waste to the cement industry or something like that. So there's a lot of zero waste plants in the U.S. now and abroad, Europe.
But I interrupted you because I was very interested in this painting process. But you were talking about comparing apples to oranges in terms of used cars and buying a new car, irrespective of its miles per gallon.
There are factors to think about beyond the impact of the manufacturing process. One of them would be new cars tend to be cleaner in a lot of ways. I mean, they have better fuel economy and they're have fewer emissions than older cars. So that's, and particularly if you have an older car that's not been maintained, it then gets into the category of the gross polluter. And those gross polluters produce so much more carbon dioxide than a regular car that they're the worst thing on the road. If you have a car that's really badly maintained and it's smoking, those things are hugely bad for the environment.
So it's better to buy a Tesla than a 30-year-old smoking jalopy, is what you're saying.
Yes, I would say so.
So we're talking about buying the cars. What about disposing of them? Just you passing along these used cars has a real impact on the environment as well, right?
Something like 65% of the car is reclaimed in junkyards. In fact, junkyards have repositioned themselves as recycling centers. So that's not bad that percentage gets reclaimed. The metal is valuable. They haven't really figured out how to deal with the plastic yet. But in Europe, there are laws that force owners of cars to take responsibility for them and make sure they're disposed of properly. In the U.S., we've had phenomena where when metal prices go down, you see a lot of abandoned cars because there's no incentive to take them to the junkyard. But more recently, I think cars have gotten pretty, there's pretty good incentive. You'll get a few $100 to take your car to the junkyard. And we're working on the idea of reclaiming the plastic, which is called scrap or something like that, and finding a use for that, being able to repurpose it. Car is one of the more recycled things we have, actually, more than other things.
Always appreciate your insights in this space. Jim Motovalli, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Sure, it was great.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by McCoy Tyner and Bob Seeger. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.